We welcome in our friend, as we do every Tuesday, author Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Hey, what's up, Kimball?
Well, man, people messing with you, blocking your path on the stairs, coughing on you. What the hell is wrong with people?
Yeah, stones in my pathway, as Robert Johnson would say. I'm actually pretty sick today. Yesterday, it's a photo of it, in case anyone thinks that I'm making this up. This guy, I did my stairs yesterday, two different stairs. I did the big stairs at Government Center, and then I went around the corner to right near where the Boston Massacre happened, and there's a smaller set of stairs. And as you know, Kimball, no two sets of stairs are exactly alike, so it's a bit of a different workout. And there was this guy standing at the top, pretty narrow stairwell, on the top stair, just with his legs out and taking up all this room. I went past him 10 times. He did not move. Coughed on me deliberately, and then yesterday I started to get sick later in the day, and now I've really been hurting. Today I couldn't even run stairs. I just walked instead and went to CVS and stocked up on stuff so I'd be able to talk.
He coughed on you like he was a redcoat and you were Crispus Attucks at the Boston Massacre.
Yeah, he coughed on me like something. I mean, how much of a dick does somebody need to be, really? And the photo, you saw the photo, right?
Oh, yeah, his leg, like, sticking out, blocking half the stairway.
Yeah, so you have to make this little pirouette at the top, like I'm some ballet dancer being all nimble. And it's pretty obvious what I'm doing if, like, you didn't see me pass you 10 times, just about. And people, they just suck the life out of you, Kimball. I find that it's harder for me to even go out and be around humans. I went down to the Starbucks to get a green tea, and I'm sitting outside to kind of decongest myself, and I overhear everything. I am like a hare, the rabbit, with my hearing, and I'm hearing the things people are saying. I literally shut the water off. You literally did that, huh? You couldn't just shut it off. You literally shut it off. And then I'm thinking, this isn't good for my BP. None of this is good. This is why we have the green tea, but we should get out of here.
Yeah. Green tea is not going to make up for the inappropriate use of
literally has become the new, like, you understand how it functions, right? People now lack the language skills to convey anything at all, so they desperately press that literally button as a way to show that they're in earnest. And you hear it all the time. And the person who said it in this particular instance was like my mom's age. That's how far the infestation is gone. You see it on Twitter. You'll see four tweets in a row. Literally the best team in the league. Really? You think it works like that, do you? Because people just can't, they can't talk. And so, yeah. But I will tell you, Mr. Kimball, people who live the longest time tend to drink four drinks more than any other drinks. And they are, in order, green tea, black coffee, and water. So get a drinking.
I love all four of them. Absolutely. All right, Colin Fleming with us on Downtown. Let's block out the rest of the world and let's focus on a little baseball on this Tuesday afternoon. You threw the gauntlet down. The greatest players of all time by position. And I don't want to say agonized because it's been fun, but boy, it's some difficult decisions along the way. Let's start behind the plate. Who have you got?
Behind the plate is, I feel like we'll probably, forecasting this, I bet you we will have the same answer for 4 to 5. Roughly half. Behind the plate, but it's closer than I would have thought in years past, I have Johnny Bench. I don't put Josh Gibson there because he died when he was 35. And it's not like Johnny Bench was some amazing force at that same age. But not to be macabre, when you do die at 35, I feel like there were things happening that weren't so hot at 30 and 32. Do you know what I mean? The player, I would say, that has gained ground, in my estimation, on Johnny Bench in the intervening years since he played, would be Gary Carter. Gary Carter is closer than one would think to being in that top spot. And as a Carlton Fisk, I mean, he's my guy, Fisk, fan in the extreme, that's an admission. Well, it doesn't really pain me because I have a lot of respect for Carter's game, but I think Bench is clearly the go-to catcher for me.
I also had Johnny Bench, and I'm a big Fisk fan. I wanted to factor in his longevity, but as we've talked about, he had some great seasons. He had some under-the-radar really good seasons, and then, like with a lot of catchers, he had some years where the injuries caught up with him and he wasn't quite as effective. But Bench had that great combination of being a tremendous defensive catcher and the best offensive force behind the plate for the better part of a decade.
I'll be frank, Fisk, I mean, he's not even really close to the top spot, but he was very inconsistent in his career. Mm. And you have to get inside the numbers to appreciate some of his better seasons. They're not what you would outrightly think of as the superior seasons. Johnny Bench had outrightly superior seasons. He's a two-time MVP. He leads the league in home runs twice. And guy is hitting like well over 40 home runs as a catcher. And maybe that doesn't mean something to baseball fans of a certain age. And Bench was before my time. I said the very end of his career, when he was playing a lot of third base, like in 1983 for the Reds. But those were numbers that just were, they were Willie Stargell type of numbers. They were rare, big bopper numbers. Guys didn't just pop 45 home runs at the time. It was really from the mid-1960s through, I'd say, 76 is the American League in 76, so it's a bit different. But Craig Nettles led the American League with 32 home runs that year, and Hal McRae had... He was the OPS plus leader in the American League, the OPS leader, rather, and he was under 900. So different league, but those were the times, and Bench was still putting up the numbers he put up.
All right, what about first base?
You know, it's going to sound strange to say this. I have reasons, many reasons, for each of the people that I have at these positions, but I actually think that everything sorts itself out pretty definitively. First base, I have Lou Gehrig. I don't know how you could, I wouldn't have someone else there. He has the, what was that, seven seasons? I think it was seven seasons with 150 plus RBI. It's the record. Nobody's close to that. It's a triple crown. His rate stats are, they're just outrageous. There's really nothing like that duo of Gehrig and Ruth for the Yankees and all of sports. And you think of the great duos. There's no shortage of great duos out there if you want to go. I mean, hell, in the Edmonton Oilers, you have Gretzky and Curry, or Gretzky and Messier, or Gretzky and Coffey. And still, nothing is really at that Gehrig-Ruth level. And Gehrig was closer to Ruth than people think. And so, obviously, it's a power position. And you're going to find many a great hitter who played. You can be, what, the 30th best first baseman of all time, the 35th, and be kind of a no-brainer Hall of Famer. But, yeah, it's Gehrig for me.
It's interesting. I had Gehrig as well. The guy I had at number two, I went round and round, but ultimately it was that power that made the difference, even though he was a great RBI producer. But Stan Musial, who was great, 331 career average, but never hit 40 homers in a season.
Musial's tricky because he played all over the field. He played all over the outfield. One of his years, and one of his best years, and he was so consistent, as you know, he was primarily a center fielder. So he's a guy who doesn't really fit in a position. I'm sure, well, they're likely all dead now, but during his time, or shortly after his retirement, there would have been people who thought of him as an outfielder, other people who thought of him as a first baseman. So he kind of slides between things. Now, Musial is perhaps the most underrated great player in any sport. He makes a strong bid. He's not quite there, but he makes a strong bid for the top 10 all-time in baseball, if you don't count pitchers. He's like number 12. I mean, he's really knocking on that door.
Second base, I suspect, will be in agreement as well. I had to go with Rogers Hornsby.
Yeah, and he's the best right-handed hitter of all time. And he may have had the best single season of anyone of all time. Now, he was not a very nice man, and he hated people. He kind of sounds, I would imagine, if he was alive, A bit like I do when I reflect upon the man on the stairs and people at the cafe. He wrote a scathing book about why he actually hated baseball. I mean, he was not someone you'd want to be having to your fun, like to your party. We're having game night. Come over. We'll do Parcheesi and Hungry Hungry Hippos. Rogers Hornsby would not be the guy to come. Oh, he'd probably dominate at Hungry Hippos with his wrist action. But he was not a very good fielder. And there's something that I think is going to be a trend as we do the rest of the position people might object to. These are kind of older players, and it sort of begs the question, what, you don't think that the players now are as good? And I sort of have an answer to that. I think that in the past, the game of baseball might have been played in a more effective, nuanced way that allowed for greater separation between the very best players and the very good players and the good players and the mediocre players and the not-so-hot players. Whereas now, everything is full throttle. Throw it as hard as you can. Swing as hard as you can. And it's really changed it into a different kind of in-the-red sort of game. And I don't know that that's the best way. I suspect it's not. To play baseball, it's the best way to hit a baseball 468 feet and throw a baseball 102 miles per hour. But I don't really think that that's the spirit of the game at its greatest sort of point of efficiency.
No, and then people will bring up the fact that some of these early players were not playing against the best black players. That's certainly true. At the same time, the conditions they were playing under in ballparks, and, you know, no lights. And so if you get a cloudy gray day, it's tough to see the ball. You're playing with old, dirty baseballs. You got guys loading up the ball with coffee grounds and Lord knows what. And travel was by train in very difficult conditions. It had to be a challenge to be a baseball player back in the teens, the 20s, and the 30s that today's modern player would have no idea about.
You wouldn't have felt fresh on a road trip.
No.
That just would have been cramped. And if someone likes old cinema or A Hard Day's Night, you get a sense for so many great old films are set on trains. So I feel like people have an idea, an approximation for what that was like at the time. These are not capacious surroundings. You're going to be in tight quarters, even if you're traveling quote unquote first class as a member of the New York Yankees or whatever team at the time. And you would have the recovery time. And then the whole thing with black baseball players, there are players that straddled the eras where they played against all white players and they played in an integrated league. And someone like Ted Williams. Ted Williams just seemed to have success against everybody,
right,
more or less.
Right.
There'd be some random player. And I don't know. It's almost like the NHL with the six-team league. And so if you were a goalie in that six-team league, a starting goalie, you were theoretically one of the six best goalies in the league, in the world.
Mm.
But the seventh best goalie was probably pretty good. But you were still going against, I don't know. I feel like, and it might be a touch naive, but I feel like by and large, we have a sense of who these players are, and certain things do more or less even out.
Shortstop, I went with an old-timer. What about you?
Yeah, and it's tough because this guy is, when you look at his numbers, you're kind of underwhelmed. I'm talking about Honus Wagner, but right. His OPS, for instance. But he was playing in a time when the ball was like when you wrap two socks together so that they don't get lost. And you're trying to send that as like a one-hopper through the infield. It's probably going to be difficult. There are cases to be made, and I'm not one to make them myself, that Wagner is the best player in the history of baseball. He is fielding the position at a high level when hops are going every which way. We've all played Little League when the ball hits that rock and comes up and hits you in the throat and you can't breathe for a while. That was sort of the conditions at the time, and he picked it pretty smoothly. So someone that I never really thought that highly of when he played, that I think more highly of now, is a Cal Ripken. And I don't think that he's number two, but you can look at something like Ripken's season of 1991, and it's one of the 15 or 20 best seasons in the history of baseball by anybody. But yeah, Honus Wagner for me. What about you?
Yeah, he was mine as well. And you know, some of those seasons, and this is when people were not hitting home runs, but what Wagner would routinely do would be to get 40 to 45 doubles and chip in another 20 triples along the way. Oh, and also go out and steal 50 bases.
You want to know a stat that tells you really, to me, it says so much about who's a great hitter. Sometimes I don't even look at things like home runs or anyone who has a lot of doubles. It's almost impossible, okay, Jody Reed, to have a lot of doubles and not, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Not be one of the best players in your era and probably all time. The reason Pete Rose, for instance, has value, because he was a singles hitter. He didn't have any power. His real value was in his doubles. Doubles machine. And someone like Tris Speaker, who's a candidate for being on this particular roster that we're talking about, crazy doubles. So much of his value was in doubles.
We're talking about the best baseball players of all time by position. Colin Fleming here. I had, I think, the hardest time at third base, and I ended up leaning on a guy that I saw play and was the best defensive player I ever saw at that position. He didn't put up the offensive numbers of a Mike Schmidt, but I went with Brooks Robinson.
I think he's a popular choice for people. They tend to have an affinity for Brooks Robinson. And I think you can make the case that the 1966 Baltimore Orioles, with Robinson at third and Louis Aparicio at shortstop, had the best defensive left side of the infield in the history of baseball. Robinson wouldn't be close to me. He wouldn't be top 10 for me. I think Mike Schmidt was a comparable fielder. And Schmidt's, he's one of those players, he's sort of like my third base version of Stan Musial, where I look at his numbers and I see the dominance. I see him leading the league in home runs. Really, it was almost like every year. And it was kind of close to every year. I see the multiple MVPs. I see the World Championship in 1980. For me, it is sort of weak position comparatively. I mean, it's not center field. He stands above everyone. He's like sort of, when I'm filling in this roster, he's one of the easiest people for me to put there. And I think his game, too, analytically, his age so well. He walked so much. He was on base so often. He only had like one down year once he figured it out when he hit under 200 right at the beginning. He was going to lead the league in home runs every year. And it might just be 38, only 38. But again, at the time, in that sort of offensively challenged 1970s decade, and he was good right up through 1987. He was the MVP in, what, 86 for another time? Yeah, I think he's just a hell of a ball player.
All right, off to the outfield, and boy, loaded with talent out there. Left field, yeah, I went with Ted Williams. Not a great defensive player, indifferent about defense, but as good a hitter as we've ever seen.
So transcendent offensively that, yeah, the defense. Think of how good you have to be in a discussion for making a roster like this when you contribute nothing save your hitting. Base running, blah, defense, blah. I think he was the best hitter of all time. I will lift your spirits with a stat for a guy who can't be on this roster in left field. Your man, Karol Yastrzemski, has the highest single season, did you know this, WAR for a position player in the history of baseball, who is not Babe Ruth with his 1967 season. Think about that. Pretty crazy.
Oh, a season for the ages. And he was always good. He was always in the upper tier. But outside of that one season, he was never the best hitter in the league.
If Babe Ruth didn't exist, that's I mean, right there. This may be the best season anyone's ever had. Isn't that crazy? Because people think of him as a compiler. We've talked about his 1968 year, and then he was good in 69, 70, and he was still like chipping in with kind of led the league in runs scored later on, and he was always dependable. He was always sort of like the baseball version of a hockey player who is getting 86 points every year, and they're sort of racking it up. Like, once Dale Hawerchuk stopped being this elite scorer after whatever his age 25 season, he was always giving you a point per game. Yastrzemski was that for a long time, but the man who came before him was should have five MVPs. He has the two. But really, it's five, like, obvious MVPs if, like, someone doesn't leave him off the ballot entirely, like, for instance, one year.
Right. Center field, I had to go with the best player I ever saw in my lifetime of watching baseball, Willie Mays.
Yeah, I thought this would be one of the ones. He's, again, one of those popular choices. Are dazzled by his all-around greatness. I don't think he's close to the player that Ty Cobb was. Ty Cobb, to me, is easily the second-best player in the history of baseball. Things people don't know about Ty Cobb. He was in the top 10 in home runs 11 times. Jim Rice was in the top 10 in home runs 7 times. Ty Cobb won a Triple Crown. And I don't know this, but I think I'm correct. Ty Cobb was in the top 10 for on-base percentage 21 times. I don't think there's anyone else in the history of baseball who was in the top 10 for anything as many as 21 times. Ty Cobb was a big guy. He was 6'1". People tend to think he's like this little dude. He wasn't. If you look at the black ink on his baseball reference page, Cobb leads the league at some point seemingly in everything. Not plate appearances and not walks. But everything else, it's Cobb. I mean, Cobb, to me, is the only guy who has an argument for being better than the player who would be next to him as we move across the outfield, for me, in this particular roster assembly.
One of the most amazing pair of stats I've ever seen, Ty Cobb in 1915, because I can't imagine anyone else has ever done anything like this. He had 99 runs batted in, and 96 stolen bases.
Cobb was, people described him as possessed. You know who, like, a sort of efficient analog for Cobb would be Michael Jordan. I think Cobb was driven like that. I think he just had that extra that people don't have in any walk of life for the most part. I think it meant more than life to him to be the best at what he did and to take his game as far as he could. And here's something about Willie Mays, too, that he's come down in my estimation over the years. Willie Mays starts being great in 1954. He'd war service the year before, so we don't really know. He's great every year from 1954 to 1966. And that's it. Do you know what I mean? Like, Hank Aaron, who for me would be the fourth best baseball player of all time, is not even in this roster because it's just one per position, started being great in 1955. He's great every single year until 1973. I look at that and I just think, that career value, I can't have Mays above Aaron. There's just too much value in that larger percentage. It's not a small percentage of years. And so I think there's a sort of Bo Jackson thing that happens with Willie Mays, the sheer athleticism, the brilliance of that athleticism.
Yeah, and I wanted to find a place to put Hank Aaron, and originally I was going to cheat and put Babe Ruth on the roster as a left-handed pitcher, but, I mean, the man changed the game like nobody else had. He's got to be your right fielder.
Yeah, he's the Gretzky of the sport, and it's quaint. It's amusing to me when people talk about Ohtani being Babe Ruth. They do not know anything about baseball history. They don't think. They don't try to learn anything. And they don't even pull up stats and understand what those stats mean. Babe Ruth is so gargantuanly more dominant than anyone else. He was out-homering entire clubs added together, and he never really stopped until he left New York and came back to Boston. I always think it's interesting that Ruth found his way back to where he started in Boston, albeit with a different team than the Red Sox. And Aaron found his way back to Milwaukee albeit with a different team than the Braves, right? People don't really talk about that. Ruth is just, he's 1981 to 82 to 85, 86, maybe 86, 87, Wayne Gretzky. That's just what he was for a long time. There's really, ironically, he never won a triple crown. You'd think that he would have, because a bunch of these guys did. But, yeah, he's one who didn't.
No, but the numbers are just absolutely ridiculous. And not just the home runs, but the batting average. I think all but one season, and until the very end with Brooklyn, all but one season when he was an offensive regular, he hit 300.
Oh, right. He soared. I mean, past that, he would have to slump and have like a broken forearm to hit 289 or whatever. He was, I mean, he's just very difficult to classify. And people can say he was playing against these guys who worked on farms in the summer. Then why was no one else coming close to doing it? Right. I mean, his teammate in Gehrig eventually, and Ruth was quite a bit older, came along and was doing his thing that was fairly close. But what's fairly close? 80% of Ruth, and it's the best first baseman of all time. So stunning. His approach to everything was radical and revolutionary. He approached the game as no one else did, and he was supposed to be this sort of rube, but he wasn't a rube based upon the way he played.
No, not at all. All right, who did you pick as your designated hitter?
Oh, I wasn't. I thought, because so many of these guys, I wondered if it would be cheating, because so many of these guys, really, all of them, if we count the National League with Bench and Schmidt, they predate the designated hitter. So I figured that would be shoehorning someone in. But if I was going to pick just an outright designated hitter, in other words, not make Stan Musial or Mel Ott
right,
the DH, I would go with Ortiz.
Yeah, that's
Ortiz
who I picked.
His numbers, they have a bit of the 1970s American League about them. He played in that 2003, 2004, of course, right, when you're coming down out of sort of the steroid times. But for a lot of Ortiz's career, 30 home runs and 100 RBI was a big deal again. And I'm not sure people know that now when they look at those numbers and they think, well, this is kind of pedestrian. It wasn't pedestrian. It was elite power. And he was one of those guys who's transcendent. I don't think Edgar Martinez is just transcendent.
No.
There are only a few players I've seen perform at that clutch level. Gretzky is one. Brady. Larry Bird at times, just to keep it in a kind of Boston nexus. But if you watched him, his ability to deliver the big hit when it was most needed, it was 1967, yes, like over a decent spread of years.
All right, who do you have for your old-school four-man pitching rotation?
I think this breaks down. It gets harder if you try to make it five, but I thought in the spirit of keeping with sort of these generations, Walter Johnson is the guy.
Yep.
I'd be giving the ball to start. Right.
Me too.
Off.
He's my number one. Yep.
It's funny because pitcher is sort of the coolest position in baseball, or it used to be. And you think, like, what sort of gave me the idea for this entire thing was someone was doing this on a Facebook baseball history group, and they had like Nolan Ryan as their number one pitcher.
Oof.
And they had everything else that was reasonable. And I just then decided to try to find how many guys were actually better than Nolan Ryan. It was not a challenge to come up with 40. And that was like leaving out Mike Mussina and people like that. But like, people, they get too excited with their own personal predilection. So Walter Johnson would be one for me. And then I'd be following that up with Christy Mathewson in the number two spot.
I went because I wanted to go righty-lefty. So I went with Koufax in the number two spot, despite the fairly limited career of big-time success. What did he have, about six ridiculously good seasons?
Yeah, but also no. Because he 61, he starts to get good. So he's really not been good for a while. Remember his like rookie card from 1955.
Mm.
62 is pretty good. 63 is awesome. 64 is missing a lot of time. 65 and 66. You're really only getting sort of three full throttle, making every start, bang on years with Koufax. And I think he sort of gets credited for more when he was not out there as often as sometimes people think. And why was he so ineffective for half of his career? I know he had to figure things out and all of that, and I'm certainly not knocking the I remember reading a biography about him and when I was in fourth grade, and I loved reading that. I was so into his stats and everything, and I've watched all of his available old games on YouTube. And for one game, I can totally understand going with him. I didn't think it through so far as lefty-righty, that kind of thing. My third guy, I guess he's my most modern guy, would be Roger Clemens. And I just think he's clearly the third best pitcher in baseball history. You can make a sort of dark horse case for him as more than that, but he's solidly entrenched, in my view, in that third spot.
Yeah, I had Clemens in my fourth spot, and in three, I went because I wanted to lean on some guys I'd actually seen. I went with Bob Gibson.
Oh, Gibson is another one. He's almost like I feel like he's a better version of Koufax in the sense that you get the dominance, you get the famous 68 season, but a few years later, he's nearly as good. And you get more term, if you will, with Gibson than you do with Koufax. You also get World Series success, and you get World Series setback. The last start of Sandy Koufax's career was against those 1966 Orioles. And a young Jim Palmer, who's still going to be doing his thing in the 80s, outpitched him. His defense didn't really help him out. So I think Gibson is, yeah, he's definitely, the most intimidating, I'd say. Pitcher. For me, in the fourth spot, I have Lefty Grove.
Oh, he was my next guy. He was my number five if I went that deep.
Greatly underappreciated pitcher. And just a stud. He was kind of the Roger Clemens of his time. For a lot of his career, I guess people could find this as a criticism. They can say, well, how good was the league? He just threw gas. He's like, I don't need a second pitch. I will just throw this past you. And I think that was pretty cool. So then he developed when he needed additional ways to attack you in the batter's box. He came up with those secondary pitches. But, when you look at his numbers and you look at the era he played in, a lot of inflated offense, sort of Pedro Martinez in 1999, 2000, where he was doing things that other guys weren't doing as the offense was just exploding all around him.
Closer, certainly colored by seeing him a number of times, both on TV and in person, and then his work in the Red Sox booth. But I went with Dennis Eckersley.
No, I did too. Oh, I thought you were going to, I thought you were going to say Mariano Rivera, and I was going to, I'll do it anyway. He shouldn't even be in the Hall of Fame because he cost the team two World Series, and his only job is to not do that. And really, he cost the Yankees the World Series two different times in 2004. Two blown saves! And he was fresh off of the 2001 gag job. Eckersley in 1990, he doesn't win the Cy Young or the MVP for this. He gets the MVP and the Cy Young really in the year of his sort of dominant reign that he doesn't deserve it. 1990, do you know what his ERA plus was? I think it was 603.
Oh.
603!
Wow.
So he's Mariano Rivera, I know he's a reliever and a starter, couldn't have an ERA plus of 603. To give someone an idea, what's Pedro Martinez's best ERA plus? It's over 200, but it's not even half of that 600. So, yeah, he gave up the big home run, but again, it was game one. If he had given that up to lose the World Series, he wouldn't be my guy, but I think he has to be my guy otherwise.
Well, it's a good team. I put our club up against anybody else's out there.
You know who you want to have, too, in the long relief role? And I bet you'll agree with this. Hoyt Wilhelm.
I had three guys. Hoyt Wilhelm. I also had Jim Constanti. And then I wanted to throw him in because I think I'm going to go to the bullpen a lot, so I wanted Mike Marshall because he's going to pitch 130 games and not complain about it.
Right. And then he'll be out of the league because you broke him a few years later.
But exactly.
Yeah, he can do his thing until then. But think of Hoyt Wilhelm. He's 29 years old when he's a rookie. and he keeps pitching until he's 49. And they're like, why don't, he was on that 54 Giants team that won it all with Willie Mays and the famous catch. And he was like 12-4 that year. He's saving games, and he's like 17th in MVP voting because they didn't think you were cool if you were a reliever. And then in 1959, what was he, on the Orioles, they're like, why don't you just be a starter? And he leaves the league in ERA. He was awesome. I mean, he's just so cool, too. So, yeah, I think we would I think we'd run away with it.
And I think this story is correct about Hoyt Wilhelm, who a decorated veteran of the Battle of the Bulge. I believe he hit a home run in his first at-bat in the major leagues and then never hit another one in 21 years.
You know, that's another thing. When people say these players, it was rigged and they were in this sort of system, enough of these guys were either just gone for a while. I mean, if you stop doing something, push-ups for a year, it becomes harder. And some of them were being shot at.
Yeah,
I don't know. Like, I give you so much, like, additional, like, wiggle room when you were in military service. And I think that's something that too often goes overlooked by people who have no idea a lot of what can be out there in the darker corners of life.
Well, it was a fun exercise. Colin Fleming, thank you as always, my friend. I hope people give you a little space, give you a wide berth there on the stairs. Hope you're feeling better soon, the Zulu warrior that you are. And we will check in next Tuesday afternoon.
Okay, appreciate it.
Thanks, Colin.